Hello and welcome to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Ben Rylan. It is Oscar time once again, and so this week, cinema is our main topic. The film critics Tim Robey and Anna Smith will join me in the studio to dissect this year's nominees, as well as running through some of this week's releases. Plus, we will take a trip to the Sundance Film Festival in Utah to find out how to get your film shown even if it hasn't been selected. Elsewhere on the program, we dig up an unknown Van Gogh painting in the Netherlands, and of course we'll have this week's global countdown as well. Stay tuned. Now, earlier on this week, the 90th Academy Award nominees were announced by Andy Serkis and Tiffany Haddish. Overall, how did you feel about the announcement, Tim?
I was quite pleased, to be honest. It peaked for me when they announced Best Director, which I think is an extremely solid list of nominees, including one female nominee, thank goodness, and a black nominee as well. Both of them terrific films. This is Get Out by Jordan Peele and Lady Bird by Greta Gerwig. But then the other three, I think, are all really deserving too. Guillermo del Toro for The Shape of Water, Paul Thomas Anderson, something of a surprise nominee for Phantom Thread, which I think is his best film since There Will Be Blood, and Christopher Nolan, who has never been nominated for Best Director before. And I really think whatever one thinks of Dunkirk, it really is quite an impressive directing achievement. I think he's very deserving there. And the interesting omission is Martin McDonagh, who I think people were expecting to get in for Three Billboards. So that, as a snapshot of the nominations, I thought that field summed up everything that they'd done quite well.
Of course, diversity will be a very big topic on the agenda this year. We'll get to that in a moment. There's always a bit of tension between the Best Director category and the Best Picture category. For you, Anna, which one comes out on top?
Well, historically, it's very rare to have a Best Picture winner that wasn't also nominated for Best Director. It does sometimes happen. So it's interesting, particularly in view of what Tim's just highlighted, to look at that. But obviously, we've got a longer Best Picture list. So, I mean, I kind of like the fact that the Best Picture list is longer and includes some things which possibly won't win for Best Director as well. But I think Lady Bird is one that I'm really excited to see included on all levels. Get Out as well, as Tim mentioned. And Three Billboards, I think, had a lot of traction really recently. There was a lot of excitement around the Golden Globes and a lot of anticipation. And it's one of the most nominated films in many, many categories in many cinemas. But for this one, I'm starting to think maybe it's not going to scoop the board after all at the Oscars.
One thing I found quite interesting is that there was an article I read a couple of weeks ago where the author had asked about, I think it was about 40 directors to name their favourite film of last year. And I would have to say at least half of them had said Call Me By Your Name was absolutely their favourite film. And the others who didn't say Call Me By Your Name had suggested Lady Bird. So really that was it as far as they were concerned. And they were all working in the industry, of course. Interesting to see that Call Me By Your Name hasn't done so well in the awards circuit so far, but it is up there for Best Picture, Tim.
And for Best Adapted Screenplay, which I now think it will win. And there's a reason why it's going to win, and it will be great if it wins, because James Ivory, now 89, will win, and it will be his first Oscar. He's been nominated many times for directing Merchant Ivory films, never won an Oscar, so that's cool. But the reason it will now win is because the competition really was The Disaster Artist, which has been nominated for the same screenplay award. But very interestingly, of course, James Franco has not been nominated for that film in the lead role, even though he won the Golden Globe as a comedy actor. And the timing of this is very significant. This is perhaps the most pointed riposte, really, that the Oscars could deliver in the wake of the Time's Up movement and the allegations against James Franco, which emerged as soon as he'd won that Golden Globe and just in time for the voters to take them on board. I really feel as though that is quite, he's been sort of shoved out for that reason. And I think the beneficiary in some ways will be Call Me By Your Name. It will win the Screenplay Oscar, and I think that's kind of nice. I like that it's got the Best Picture nomination too. It's unfortunate, you know, there's not room in Best Director for achievements like Luca Guadagnino and for Sean Baker as well, who I think has sadly not made it with the Florida Project in either Best Film or Best Director. Big favourite of mine on this programme, The Florida Project, and I think possibly the most hard-done-by film that we've seen on the list out of all the snubs, if you like.
Yeah, I agree. Absolutely. I think it really should have.
That was another one in that everyone had been talking about last year, Anna, that didn't really make any of the nominations here. But just on that Me Too movement topic, it's going to be unavoidable, of course. We are going to expect it to pop up at the Oscars. It's going to be awkward when it does pop up, though, isn't it? There's no way of avoiding that, especially given that we've got Jimmy Kimmel back as host. My own two cents on this is that perhaps they could have chosen a host that was a little bit outside the box, a little bit not what we're so used to expecting at the Oscars.
Possibly a woman, I mean.
Well, exactly. Wouldn't that have been great to see? Yes, it is a bit sort of business as usual for them, isn't it? I think it's very interesting to think that the nominations seem more risky than the choice of host. And when you look at last year, it's since pointed out that, you know, James Franco this year has been snubbed possibly because of the allegations regarding his behaviour. Now, last year, Casey Affleck won Best Actor for Manchester by the Sea, having had some allegations against him himself. So it's very interesting to see how the tides have turned, even though nothing has gone to court, as far as I know, in these things. So it's very, very interesting. And it seems like, especially when you look at the fact that we have a Best Cinematographer for the first time, female nomination, and Mudbound, you know, Dee Rees, a female-directed film, is showing up in a couple of categories. So it just feels like things are moving on in that way.
Tim, do you think it matters so much who hosts the Oscars? I mean, aside from being able to be entertaining, obviously it's a terrifying role to take on. You can really screw it up, as James Franco and Anne Hathaway would know very well. But does it really matter that Jimmy Kimmel is the one hosting? Would it have said a lot if they had have chosen someone like Whoopi Goldberg, for example?
I mean, I really liked Jimmy Kimmel's stint last year hosting. I thought he handled the finale, the shock win of Moonlight and the wrong film being called out, very well. He kept a really cool head and kind of played it entertainingly. I think possibly he's being rewarded for that. And I hope that he'll tread the right line in terms of confronting the issue and possibly being quite witty about it without turning it into too much of a joke, which is the danger. You don't want to just turn it into a game. So, because it needs to be taken seriously. I think we're certain to see some speeches from some of the female winners in the acting categories, say. Frances McDormand, if she were to win, I'm sure will make some remarks about it all. So the responsibility won't entirely fall on Jimmy Kimmel, and I'm sure that the producers of the show will make sure that that's not the case. I'm kind of fine with him doing it. I'm pleased we've actually got Joanna Lumley over here doing the BAFTAs, though. I think that's a refreshing change. That'll be good to see.
Just before we move on from this, Anna, one danger I think we have is that the Oscars, being the big awards as far as the industry is concerned, are expectations going to be a little bit too high, given that we're just so soon after the Oscars So White controversy, we're in the midst of the Me Too movement at the moment. People are going to be expecting an awful lot from this. Is there perhaps the danger that no matter what the Oscars delivers, there's just going to be a lot of people who are disappointed?
I think that's the case every year. But, I mean, every year there's the chat about diversity, as you mentioned, and they do have some people of colour nominated in the lead categories. But at the same time, if they don't win, there will be those comments, and the balance isn't still as good as it could be. But wow, can you imagine if Get Out won Best Picture or something? That would be pretty special. I think it's a year where anything could happen, and I'm quite excited.
Well, if you want to find out who takes the prizes this year, then the Oscars will take place on Sunday, the 4th of March. Now to another big film event happening this week now. Each year, thousands of filmmakers from around the world apply to the Sundance Film Festival, hoping their film will get in. But of course, most who don't make it take no for an answer. But not everyone. Correspondent James Nelson made his way to the festival and found a rich vein of filmmakers who show their films at Sundance unofficially.
As a light snow falls, Main Street in Park City is packed with stargazers, movie makers, and then one of the movie stars is spotted. It's Deborah Massing, with her entourage, heading for the premiere of her movie, Search.
Hey, Catherine.
Oh, you know what? To me, Sundance has always been where the cool kids are. And at 49, I finally made it.
Thanks, Deborah.
You guys need a ride?
A ride and a movie. Two important things the throngs at Sundance are looking for. And that's the idea that hit New York filmmakers Eden Marichal and Seiza Plager. They're showing their movie Bruce in a van they call the Bruce Van. The movie is a comedy feature about a guy, Bruce, coming of age, but he's probably too old.
Crash Dance. Out of pure love. Yeah. Pure love to Sundance and Slam Dance.
It's a very innovative way to kind of be disruptive.
Yeah.
Eden Marichal, writer, director, actor, say co-writer, director, actor, one of the executive producers and one of the producers on Bruce, with four exclamation points.
and a driver.
Yes, and also a driver. I'll take you anywhere you want to go in Park City till the 25th.
You know, the energy in the air is always wonderful at Sundance. This is another element, having your own movie in a van. Talk about how that came into being. Where'd the idea come from?
Well, the genesis of it was, we were waiting to hear back from Sundance. We didn't get in. And then we talked about, I don't think there was that much frustration. We were really proud of the art that we made, and we wanted to find ways to get it to the people, because so many people work so hard on this film.
Thank you, Sue. Thanks for having us here. Thanks to everyone for coming.
At a bookstore in the heart of Park City, Utah, Dan Mervish is telling movie lovers everything you want to know about film festivals, even when you're not invited.
Book called The Cheerful Subversive's Guide to Independent Filmmaking. And just briefly, what the book is about, because I want to get some of our talent from our film. I made a film 23 years ago that didn't get into Sundance, and so we had heard of some individuals that had gone in previous years and just come to Park City, where Sundance is, and done their own renegade screenings. And so we took that idea, but we combined it with a dozen feature filmmakers and a dozen short filmmakers, and we called ourselves Slam Dance and made our own festival that's literally across the street, a snowball's throw across the street from Sundance, and we've been doing that for 23 years.
Theoretically?
Yeah, well, your story is basically
completely original. Back inside the van, passengers watch the coming-of-age movie, chat with the stars who are up front, and like festival-goer Elizabeth Ness, wonder why someone hasn't thought of this before. You're able to see a bit of a movie while you're going around Sundance. Tell me what you think about that and what you're seeing on the screen here.
I think more people should do this. I don't know why this hasn't been done before, because it's sort of genius. In New York, we have taxi TV. So whenever you're stuck in a taxi, you are watching a screen, and there's like lots of advertising, or there's like short little segments from whatever, and so you see it all the time. Why do I not see this at festivals like Sundance? I don't know.
Give us a holler when you need, if you need another lift.
Yeah, I will. All right. Absolutely. I want to see more of it, so I will.
Yeah. We'll remember where you left off.
Yeah. Thanks.
All right.
Thank you so much. Yeah. I really appreciate it.
Great job. It literally just takes one person. So out here, it's like, you don't know who's going to get in your van. So yes, we don't have like the red carpet per se, but we do have the access. Like you're talking about, some, and it could be, we met some ladies earlier today that have a movie club where they meet once a month and watch, you know, and watch movies together and then have dinner. It's like, those are the people that will spread the word and that we're making movies for. All right, so we're going to, is everybody going to Main Street, or are we going to other places?
Yep.
Oh, dope.
Main Street?
Yeah.
All right. Sir, do you need a lift? We're giving free rides. You sure?
The Bruce van makes its way past the famed Egyptian Theater, where many of the festival movies are screened, says a pledger who does some of the driving and is an actress in the film, eyes the crowd outside and ponders the future.
I definitely feel like we are part of Sundance. I'm shocked at how many people have already said, oh, we heard about this van. Oh, we heard. You're the Bruce is an asshole? So it's surprising and amazing, because it does, it makes me feel that you don't have to be accepted to be a part of things. And then every time we drive by the Egyptian, in my head, it's just, we'll be there. We have plenty. Eden has amazing scripts. We'll be there one day.
How y'all doing? We're having a free screening of a feature that we made.
How
y'all doing? We're having a free screening of a feature that we made. It's called Bruce.
Thanks.
Get a chance to check it out. It's free.
Great.
It's at crashdance.com. Anybody else? Would you like that?
Sure.
It's a free screening for a film. And if you guys need a lift, and you're caught and the bus is not coming, if you see that Bruce van right there, we'll pick you up.
A free shuttle around town in a warm van. And a movie. Another one of the fun rides you can find at the Sundance Film Festival.
You're listening to The Monocle Arts Review with me, Ben Ryland. I'm joined in the studio today by the film critics Tim Roby and Anna Smith. We've discussed the Oscars, but now let's move on to some of the week's film releases, starting now with the science fiction comedy Downsizing. Anna, where's the story here?
So the idea is that a couple in an uncertain future in America where there are ecological problems and financial problems, they decide to shrink themselves down and become part of a community who live in a supposed paradise because you get a lot more for your money when you're very tiny. So Matt Damon and Kristen Wiig star in this, and it starts off kind of this sci-fi comedy social satire, and then it morphs into several different things from there. It's quite a surprising film.
It is very surprising. I managed to catch a viewing of this one. We'll discuss it in a moment, but first, here is a clip.
That's Dave, Dave Johnson.
Hey, everybody.
And Carol.
He never struck me as the kind of guy who'd go get small.
Downsizing takes the pressure right off.
Plus, you're really making a difference.
You mean all that crap about saving the planet?
Yeah.
Downsizing is about saving yourself. We live like kings. Got the best houses, best restaurants, Cheesecake Factory. Got three of them.
In Leisureland, your $52,000 translates to $12.5 million to live on for life.
Wow.
Do you understand that you will undergo the permanent and irreversible medical procedure commonly known as downsizing, and that your bodies will be approximately 0.0364% of their current mass and volume?
All right, this is a very, very bizarre film. I have to give it to Alexander Payne for coming up with this idea. Tim, as Anna alluded to, this film has some very surprising twists and turns as it kind of changes its outfit as you go along. It didn't really do it for you, though.
It didn't, actually, I must say. I have quite a lot of small issues with the film. I don't really mind it trying out a range of tones. It kind of shifts from this kind of satire to a kind of environmental allegory. I don't mind that. They could have made that work. It actually doesn't really work. It stops being funny at a certain point, but then it also ceases to be anything else. I didn't find it at all satisfying. But the really big issue I had with it, and this bothered me enormously all the way through, was that I think it's one of the most heteronormative films I've ever seen. The only concept that Alexander Payne can come up with in terms of downsizing is that you have to do it as a straight couple, and everyone who goes into this program seems to be a straight couple, and that's what happens. You wind up in your perfect luxury house, you're a straight couple, you live the rest of your life with loads more money. The idea of trying to do it in any other configuration is absolute anathema. And when Matt Damon is presented with not being in that perfect bubble, he basically has a breakdown. It's like the film can't conceive of how you would go through life not as a straight couple, essentially. And then it comes around at the end and does the same thing to you again at the very end. I thought this was extraordinary. It had a chance to basically kind of confront the whole of humanity and deal with the environment and all of its crises, but instead it just narrows itself right back down to what's Matt Damon's love life going to be, and that's the really important thing. This really infuriated me. I actually found it extremely dismaying and quite depressing. I can't believe that in this day and age that this film is kind of putting that out there, to be honest.
That's an interesting criticism, actually. As I watched the film, that particular aspect had not really struck me, but one thing that did strike me was that this is very much aimed towards a certain type of lifestyle in America, isn't it? All of these little downsizing communities, they are sort of taking the guise of giant big malls that you'd see in the middle of America in these sorts of towns that don't really appeal in any great way. All the houses will look very much the same. It's all very much this factory cookie cutter sort of American lifestyle, isn't it? It at least in the first half, it feels as though it's quite a critique on modern America, but not all of modern America. Perhaps one might call it Trump's America, Anna.
Yes, I would agree. And I think, I think Tim's point is really interesting. I felt that was one of the reasons it did present only straight couples, because it was presenting this really narrow lifestyle, which it was critiquing. And it was sort of saying that this very suffocating, suburban, sanitized, homogenized life, which of course we've seen shown in many satires before. But I thought it did that very well. But I do agree that it's slightly lost its way. But I still felt intrigued by it. And I still felt gripped by it because I was so interested to see where it was going to go. And I thought it had some very sincere intentions. And I think it was trying to say something very valuable about the environment, but I don't think it quite succeeded.
One other problem is that we begin in Norway. It's not just a satire about American living. The scientist who comes up with this idea is Norwegian, and he and his wife undergo it, and some of the sort of sample of experimental subjects do it. And then we shift to America to see how it would affect, as you rightly say, the kind of the sort of almost like the paradigm of American living in your McMansion or whatever. So, okay, we can give it a certain amount of latitude for satirizing that idea. But then we go back to Norway, and we're meant to be embracing a kind of global concept now, and we're meant to be looking at a global community and how that would be impacted by it. And I still felt that it had all the same problems. I thought it was essentially presenting the world as just a sort of larger version of America, really. And I think that's absurd. I think it's Alexander Payne's kind of most flawed concept in the end. I really feel as though lately he's been losing his way film by film since the early days of Election and Sideways and so on.
I suppose we do need to ask the question, if you were given the opportunity to downsize, would you go with it?
Depends if the world's ending. And if it'll save the world, then yes.
I don't know. I've seen some of that. I've seen those kits of miniature IKEA furniture that you can buy. It's very, very affordable. I don't know. You could definitely, the idea that's presented in the film, that you can create your perfect house and furnish it very cheaply, that's a very compelling one.
Let me put it this way. I certainly wouldn't downsize into the downsized world in this film. That's not what I would do. I would have to find an entirely different one.
Fair enough, too. Well, Downsizing is out in cinemas right now. This month, we have two big animation releases, Pixar's Coco and Nick Park's Early Man. Let's start now with Coco, in which we meet Miguel, a young boy who's ended up in the colorful land of the dead, despite being alive. Anna, how did that come about?
Well, Miguel is obsessed with music, but his family seriously disapprove. There's some kind of family secret that makes him think that they hate music. But he escapes to the graveyard and discovers an old guitar, which magically transports him from the grave of his idol into the land of the dead. And therefore, he has adventures and meets his own ancestors.
Well, let's hear Tim's reaction in a moment, but first, a clip.
I know your great-great-grandpa.
Ooh.
I'll get you to him.
What are you doing?
I'm walking like a skeleton.
No, skeletons don't walk like that.
It's how you walk.
No, I don't. When there's no one left in the living world who remembers you,
you disappear from this world.
But you can change that.
We gotta find my great-great-grandpa.
You gotta do it by sunrise.
What happens at sunrise?
You'll be stuck here forever.
What?
Ugh. Bittersweet Symphony as the background music to a Pixar animation. That's not something I ever thought I would hear.
Thankfully, it's not used in the film itself. but no, this is lovely, as you would expect from Pixar. It's very engaging. It's very colourful. It's quite touching. It's quite funny. It sort of does everything they do pretty well. It doesn't do anything extraordinarily new, and I sort of thought that it felt a bit like a really good film by one of their rivals in a way. It felt like it was sort of following a fairly formulaic arc a lot of the time, but I still totally went with it. I really like the music. I really like Gael García Bernal's role in it. He does a lovely job. And the kind of rules governing going back and forth between the world of the living and the world of the dead are done very ingeniously, and it's pretty sort of straightforward. There was another film about the Day of the Dead called The Book of Life that came out a few years ago, which Guillermo del Toro produced. It's very similar to this, and I sort of wonder how the two films in production kind of got along with each other, if you know what I mean, because it does feel as though there's a strange overlap there. But this one, I think, will win the Best Animated Film Oscar this year. It's the front runner to do so. It's not a particularly amazing year for that category, in fairness, but I think it will be a perfectly respectable winner.
I love animation as much as anyone, but I have to say the animation category at the Oscars is always dreadfully dull. You just always know exactly what's going to win it, I find. And often with these sorts of films, there's something very, very serious rooted at the core of the film. How did that fare in this one?
I think it's got something that is very relatable. It's about family, but it's about ancestry. It's very, very Mexican, and it draws a lot from the local culture. And it's about respecting your ancestors. It's about getting to know your family. It's about respecting the elderly. And so it's something that I think is one to take the whole family to. But I actually did find it very moving. I mean, maybe I'm a soft touch, but I was sat in a screening. It was just me and one security guard, because I was lucky enough to be doing an interview for it. It was one of those solo screenings. And me and the security guard, we were both crying by the end of it, just the two of us in the screening room. It just overwhelms you, even if you know what it's going to do. It really tugs on the heartstrings. But I think that there were points where it was just sort of ambling along in a very sweet and pretty way, but then when it hits, it really hits you where it hurts.
Animations have, I feel like they've become quite common, I suppose, in the past few years, and it does feel as though we've got to a point where I suppose our expectations have been raised quite a lot with animations, especially from Disney and from Pixar and from so on, to the point where often it's quite difficult to get the kind of animation or the kind of reaction to an animated feature film that is on par with some of the classics that we've known in the past. Have we reached some sort of saturation point, do you think, Tim, where it's just so hard for something to break through in this with the same sort of reaction that maybe The Lion King got in the 90s and Toy Story got in the early 2000s?
Yeah, I do. I really hear you, actually. actually, because I think it has been a lean few years. There have been a lot of very good ones, but there's not really been a Toy Story since at least Toy Story 3. There hasn't really been a Lion King. I think the golden age of the 90s is something to look back on, and there have been kind of little peaks since then. I really love The Incredibles among Pixar's kind of post-2000 output probably the most. A lot of people really loved Inside Out. I kind of nearly really loved Inside Out. But this one it's sort of not shooting so high in my kind of estimation. It's sort of settling for being really, really, really pleasant entertainment with a few sort of gentle little things to say about dealing with death and grief and with kind of coming to terms with your love of family. One thing I really liked was that the way it treats the character of the father, and there's a sort of twist in store, and it's a twist that goes against what Hollywood normally does with father figures, I feel. It really nicely recuperates the father within the kind of family unit. That I thought was a refreshing touch as well. So there's plenty to like in it. I'm waiting for that next animation that's going to absolutely blow us all away and prove that the art form has new directions to go in.
Well, I suppose Disney is quite busy cannibalizing all of its old classics for the live-action genre. But let's move along now to a different style of animation. This is Early Man. It's the latest from Wallace and Gromit creator Nick Park. The prehistoric tale follows a caveman called Doug, of course D-U-G for those playing at home, whose tribe is trying to protect their home from the evil Lord Nuth and his Bronze Age city. Let's hear a clip.
You leave my tribe in peace!
How dare you!
Oh.
I'll take him away and kill him.
Slowly.
Ah!
Idiots.
If we win, we can have our valley back.
And if we don't beat them?
We'll spend the rest of our lives working down a mine.
No! What's a mine?
The voices of Tom Hiddleston, Eddie Redmayne, and Maisie Williams are in this one. It is, of course, a very British affair. Do these sorts of films travel very well outside of Britain, Anna?
I think this one might travel slightly better. I mean, of course, the Wallace and Gromits are very popular and very easy to understand, perhaps whatever language you speak, which is very helpful. But this one might translate better because everyone knows about soccer stroke football, and it's perhaps got a less cosy British village feel. For me, that worked against it. I'm a big fan of the Wallace and Gromit films, and I felt that they have this uniquely British flavour and humour, and the whole concept of this parochial life is what gives it its strength and its great humour. And this, for me, I laughed about three times. I really didn't find it very funny at all, and I found it slightly annoyingly anachronistic.
Well, here it's not just British humour, it's British football humour quite specifically. I saw it with a friend from Texas who, he really enjoyed it, but there were quite a few jokes where he was like, what was that referring to? And things just didn't translate quite. There were references to, you know, he thinks it's all over, it is now, and all the catchphrases and slang of football fandom. I'm not a big football fan, but I actually found the film really, really genial entertainment. It doesn't set itself any particularly difficult tasks. It's not trying to move you. It's not trying to kind of sell you on the kind of heroism of the human spirit. It just wants to give you a good time. I like the idea that within, you know, minutes of flinging up the bone in 2001 A Space Odyssey, Early Man has discovered football. A sort of prehistoric man just getting in straight into football, I think, was quite a nice witty idea that just runs all the way through. Caveman football antics, basically. So you have a Stone Age team versus this Bronze Age team. And I like the fact that the Bronze Age team are presented as kind of like characters out of Monty Python and the Holy Grail. Tom Hiddleston as the kind of snooty king, doing pretty much a John Cleese impression. There's plenty in there that I just really recognised and kind of found quite funny. A lot of puns, though. My goodness, Aardman like a pun, don't they? And there's a pun a minute in this thing, and not all of them hit, I don't think.
I think puns might be quite a British thing as well. I find Brits, in my experience, Brits really love a good pun. I'm not very good at them. We've got to finish this one up, but I'll get the pick from both of you. If you had to choose one, Early Man or Coco, which one is it, Tim?
It's probably narrowly Coco, but they're for very different audiences, I think.
Anna?
Coco, definitely.
Early Man and Coco are out in cinemas now. Before we have this week's global countdown, let's head to Amsterdam for an artistic discovery. The city's Van Gogh Museum receives at least 200 requests a year to verify possible new works by the Dutch painter. 99.9% of the time, they're false alerts. But every now and then, the real deal crops up, as was the case recently with a drawing unearthed from a private collection. Monocle's Amsterdam correspondent Venetia Rainey has the story.
I've come to Singelaren, a private art museum in a leafy town about 20 kilometers outside of Amsterdam. The current exhibition is all from the private collection of the Van Vlissingen Art Foundation and features works by Picasso, Gauguin, Degas, and Monet. But I'm here to see something even more extraordinary, a never-before-seen Van Gogh drawing. It's being exhibited alongside a second, newly attributed similar work.
So here we are approaching the twins, two sketches of Van Gogh, executed in black chalk. So it's a black and white image of Montmartre, still completely empty. You see a hill, you see a little mill and a small factory standing, and for the rest it's almost empty. I think it's a strong picture.
Museum director Jan Rudolf de Lorm.
He made it when he just entered Paris in the beginning of 1886, and he was learning to sketch with nude models and plasters, as you can see here in the description. And the way he is experimenting with the lining, with the rubbing, is completely comparable with the nude studies we know of him.
The story of the new drawing's discovery dates back 7 years to a lecture given in France by Fred Lehman, a Van Gogh expert. After the lecture, Fred was approached by an American attendee.
So this American, he told to Mr. Lehman, well, my grandmother, she has a drawing hanging on the attic. And I saw the picture, and he showed a photograph. He said, well, the family story is could be a Van Gogh. And Fred Lehman, who worked in the Van Gogh Museum for 10 years, he got a sort of a kick, instant kick, and said, wow, this could be the real thing.
But Fred needed to be sure. So, several years later, when working for the Van Vlissingen Art Foundation, he arranged to get the drawing looked at by the researchers at the Van Gogh Museum.
I always call it the Van Gogh police. When they say, this is Van Gogh, then the world has a new Van Gogh.
If the Van Gogh police had a chief constable, it would be Theo Meidendorp, the museum's senior researcher.
Hello.
Hi, Theo.
Hi, Theo. Hi.
Anisha, how are you doing?
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
Upstairs, yeah.
Yes.
The moment Theo got the email with a photo of the drawing, he knew immediately that this wasn't like the 200 or so other requests he gets yearly about possible Van Goghs. But to be sure, he got to work examining it.
Right.
The paper was exactly what Van Gogh used at that time. So was the black chalk. And there was also a watermark, something that appears on many of the painter's drawings.
And then, of course, is that what we especially wanted to know, because it came out of the blue, we didn't know the image yet, and it was clearly a Van Gogh drawing. Where did it come from? And in this case, these drawings always come with a certain story.
They were told that the owner's grandmother had been bought it when she was younger, possibly as an 18th birthday present in 1911. So Theo delved into the Van Gogh Museum's extensive archives, which has hundreds of documents detailing works loaned or sold. Eventually, he found a slip listing 9 drawings sent to London on view for a collector around that time.
And there were 9 of them with numbers, and all of them had been identified, so we know which drawing it was, except for one. And this one had the number 123, 123, and it has a title, Montmartre, Early French Period.
They immediately requested to take the drawing out of its frame to check the back for a number.
And then the wonderful thing is, indeed, when you do so, and you're working, you're standing all around it, and you cut it open, and yes, there it is. Well, number 123, yes.
It's a cold, grey day in January, but here outside the Van Gogh Museum in Amsterdam, there are still some people queuing to get inside. Although the museum here doesn't own the new drawing, its discovery has allowed them to reattribute a similar black and white sketch of Montmartre in their collection that had previously been written off for being too unlike anything else by Van Gogh. This makes the new drawing a significant missing link, according to museum director Axel Ruger.
Well, in a way, because this one drawing in our collection was always considered, you know, an oddity and one could never place it stylistically, because of this new discovery, we now get yet another dimension of Van Gogh's work, and that is to say the very early period when he arrives in Paris, coming from the Netherlands and Antwerp, how he worked then.
The Dutch painter's enduring global popularity and fame means that most people have already searched their house for hidden Van Goghs, and Ruger says it's unlikely there will be many more discoveries such as this. But then again, as the story of this simple sketch tucked away in an attic shows, you just never know. For Monocle in Amsterdam, I'm Venetia Rainey.
Thanks to Venetia Rainey for that report. Now we're nearing the end of the show, which means that, of course, it's time for the Global Countdown. This week, to count down the top five tracks of another country, we're joined, in Fernando's absence, by Monocle's Chiara Remella. Welcome, Chiara. Where in the world are we heading?
Well, where else if not Italy, my very own home country?
A chart that you know very well, I imagine.
Well, I must say, I have been out of Italy for 8 years, but every time I dip my toes back into what's going on in the charts, there's always something slightly familiar that crops up. And you'll see when we climb back to number one what I'm referring to.
Uh-oh.
Three out of the five top songs on the countdown today are actually by Italian artists, which I think is fairly uncommon in a global context, even though these acts really, really always struggle to make it abroad because the context is so insular and so very cheesy. Nonetheless, yes, the local support is really quite strong. Also, the support of the actual singing talent shows is still enormously high. So a lot of the songs that we'll be listening to actually come via one talent show or another.
Well, let's open our minds and start with number five. What is in fifth place, Chiara?
So we have Shade with Federica Corte with Irresistibile. Shall we take a listen?
Let's listen. Un telescopio a casa e guardo sempre su quei cieli perché tu mi scrivi solo se sei lì nei pianeti e fa male. Sì, ma non ci devi pensare. Nella mia testa c'è una tempesta e non è temporaneo questo temporale. Sbaglio a chiamare, sbaglio a chiamare. Niente da fare, lasciami stare, tutto è normale. Abbracciati da sola che ora me ne devo andare. E forse ti sembrerò un'idiota totale. I mean, that's a very fast delivery of lyrics, isn't it, Chiara? Is that your karaoke tune next time we all head out?
A lot of people tell me that I speak faster when I speak Italian. I wonder if it's a common trait of all of us.
Or did that sound fast to you, or was that just me?
I think that was just the very, very good rapping abilities of Shade there, actually. Shade, class 1995, born in Torino, like me, who paired up with Federica Corta, who's a third place winner, actually, of Amici at a talent show. Now, what's interesting about this track is not only that it talks about unrequited love and all of the things that you'd expect from a song like this, but mainly that its video is actually modelled after La La Land. So the whole thing is shot as if it was La La Land, like complete with her in yellow dress and him in shirt a la Ryan Gosling.
Tim, did that really get it for you?
Isn't the cliche that it's irate Italians who speak fast? So maybe she's just really cross.
You would, if that was a situation, you would.
I hope that's not a true cliche, or I might have encountered a few people that are mad at me and I never even knew it. Let's move along, Chiara. What's at number four?
So we have Coez with Non c'è la musica. C'è troppa luce dentro la stanza, questo caldo che avanza, io non dormirò. E scusa se non parlo abbastanza, ma una scuola di danza nello stomaco. E balla senza musica.
All right, that's a little bit more approachable, I suppose, isn't it? I can almost understand some of what was being sung there. Chiara, for those who are perhaps not multilingual, tell us what is being sung about.
It's again a love story. It's more of an upbeat, well, not really upbeat, but it's a bit of a declaration of love and how he wants to take us to the sea, and there is no need for music in a way because she dances even when there is no music. So it's quite sweet. My favourite line, though, has got to be una scuola di musica nello stomaco, which means I have a dance school in my stomach, which I think is so sweet.
A dance school.
Yeah, like a dance school, like a like a class, like a dance class in my stomach.
I'm sure it sounds good in Italian, but that
little bit uncomfortable to me.
Would you host an entire classical dance class in your stomach? I don't know. Would you fit it? I don't know.
Certainly not a tap dance school. Can you imagine?
That'd be terrible, though. Paso doble as well. Anyway, I think what's interesting about Coez is that this is his fourth studio album, and it's the first one that's garnered him some success in a top 10. And I think we're in a situation in Italy at the moment where finally some artists that have been somewhat kind of underground rap artists have become very popular, because on the wave that was launched by two people who are now very, very famous, called Fedez and J-Ax, who then also became kind of very media popularity figures. Now a lot of these kind of second-tier artists that have lived a bit in the underground in the case of Coez, for over a decade, are now coming to the surface. And I think a song like this is a sweet counterpoint to the much more commercial kind of rap that we get fed. So I welcome Coez.
Oh, well, cultural movements on the way then, Ian Italy. That's got to be good news. Anna, before we move on, if you were to open your stomach up to a dance school, what kind of dance school?
I think a waltz would be more comfortable.
I'm with you on that, actually. All right, let's go to number three. Chiara, what's happening at number three?
So we have another Italian band, despite their name. This is Maneskin with Chosen. This is the music, this is love, this is what I live for. So let me introduce myself, cause I can take no more. It is too many stupid people and they have control. I got a plan in my mind and I won't let go. I got the pistol in my head, pop, pop, and shot that I don't wanna hear. So please shut up and now. Hey, yeah, yeah. Follow me now. These guys are really, really young. They're 16, 17, 18. They're a band from Rome, also second place at X Factor 2017. They are all donning these kind of 70s boho outfits, like proper rock star kind of, you know, you could kind of expect it from the music, couldn't you?
That totally, you know what it made me think of? It sounded like Italian Arctic Monkeys. I think they've been listening to Arctic Monkeys and they're going on that.
Although
that
jag, less, you know, less leather, more flowy, you know, patterned jackets, long hair, bare chests, the lot.
Chiara, time is short. Let's move along now to second place.
It's Camila Cabello with Havana, obviously famous worldwide and so in Italy.
We've all probably heard that song quite a few times now, I think, Chiara. Perhaps we should jump right to what's making number one, because this is another artist who I'm pretty sure we're all very well aware of. Shall we just give it away? Who is it, Chiara?
Well, it's Ed Sheeran, isn't it? Obviously.
Oh, for goodness sake. Literally has let us down.
The collective sigh.
Yeah. I know, but we do have a bit of a spin on this, because the song that's actually making the top of the charts is just perfect, obviously. But Ed Sheeran, other than making a version of this song with Beyoncé, famously, perfect duo, has actually made a version of this with none other than Andrea Bocelli, Italy's sweetheart and opera singer. So even though the version with Bocelli is not actually topping the charts, it's just the original that's topping the charts, we figured we could play for you just a little taster of the Italian version, because I think it's worth listening to. And
let's
then you'll tell me what you think.
Is his Italian quite impressive, Chiara?
I'm fairly impressed, because the accent, you know, actually there was a big tradition in the 60s of English acts singing in Italian or in other languages for the European markets. So I've heard a lot of, I guess, English songs that people are used to listening to in English in Italian with these terrible accents that we then kind of get used to. So, you know, we just go, cello grigio su, cello grigio su, foglie gialle giù, and the rest of it, you know? But I think Ed Sheeran's effort here is fairly respectable from the point of view of the pronunciation.
We'll give him good pronunciation.
Yeah. Oh, well, I believe that brings us to the end of today's programme. Big thanks, of course, to Anna Smith and Tim Roby for taking us through today's cinema releases as well. This show was produced by Holly Fisher, and I'm Ben Ryland. We'll be back at the same time next week. But for now, let's play things out with some more of Who? Ed Sheeran. Getting into the Italian spirit, though, here he is with Andrea Bocelli. Thanks for listening. Baby, I'm dancing in the dark with you between my arms, barefoot on the grass, listening to our favorite song. When you said you looked a mess, I whispered underneath my breath, but you heard it, darling. You look perfect.
tonight. Sei la mia donna, la forza delle onde del mare. Cogli i miei sogni, i miei segreti, molto di più.